Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
Today's show is brought to you by Hearst Ranch Grass-Fed Beef, available on the internet at HearstRanch.com.
Good afternoon and welcome to Straight No Chaser on the Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Katie Kiefer. We are broadcasting from the back of Roberta's restaurant at 261 Moore Street, where brunch is being served. Today's program is featuring on the phone none other than Jason Hirsch. Jason Hirsch is the food editor for the Associated Press. He oversees writers covering everything from breaking news to restaurant and retail trends, as well as a team of chefs developing recipes for use in hundreds of newspapers around the nation. He has written two cookbooks, including High Flavored Low Labor, Reinventing Weeknight Cooking. He tweets at JM Hirsch and blogs at lunchboxblues.com. Jason, welcome. I mean, you are arguably the Mac Daddy of all food editors, am I right?
Well, I don't think I'm going to go out on a limb and say that.
But I don't mind saying
I consider myself lucky enough to have a fantastic job in the food world where I get to have a lot of influence on the food news and recipes and so forth that people read in newspapers across the country. It's a responsibility I take very seriously, but it's also a lot of fun because, you know, my job is to spot trends and spot news and listen as well and hear what people want to know more about and what people are cooking in home kitchens as well as restaurant kitchens. So it's a great job. I love
it. It's fantastic. I'm deeply envious. So let me get right down to business. How do you pick your stories? I mean, you must be inundated. I know AP has hundreds and hundreds of reporters. How do you pick the stories that you think are the most worthy to go out on the wire?
Well, you know, I mean, the first thing is you can never do them all. As any journalist knows, there's never enough time, energy, workers, just anything to do all of the stories that truly merit reporting and writing. But, you know, I mean, there's a couple of factors involved. Obviously, breaking news is one of them, and, you know, which we recently saw with the kind of uprising, if you will, in terms of pink slime. You know, this is news that broke, and the AP responded to it, and we covered it extensively, and we get the stories out very quickly. So that's obviously one part of it. The other part is watching for trends. You know, I try to keep an eye out, and I listen to my writers as well. You know, what are people doing? What are people reading? What are people talking about in terms of food and what they're eating, what they're cooking, you know, where they're going out to eat, and what's going on in food politics, and what are our politicians talking about? What's on the agenda? And we're always, of course, trying to stay one step ahead of the news and kind of anticipate what's coming down the pike so that we can tell people. And then, of course, there's the other part of the job, which is, you know, recipes and cooking news, where, you know, we try to anticipate what people want to be feeding their families. And we generate a lot of recipe content. I think what a lot of people don't realize is my job is actually two jobs, and which is one, I edit news and trend stories and business stories for AP, but the other part of the job is the test kitchen, running the test kitchen, where we develop a lot of the recipes that Americans see in their food section of their local newspaper.
Yeah, amazing. I mean, that's got it. That's a full-time job right there. So I'm guessing you're working like 24 hours a day. I should be really lucky that you came on the show today, right?
It often feels that way.
I can imagine. Plus, you have kids.
You know, I have a great team that lets me do what I do. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I have chefs who work for me in terms of developing recipes. I do some development, but not nearly as much as I used to.
I can imagine.
And, but, you know, they're great. They really, the test kitchen runs itself, and they do a great job with that. I also have, you know, a tremendous number of writers, as you say, across the AP, and as well as freelancers, who do a great job of, seeking out the news and reporting it.
Mm-hmm. Now, you guys, your stories are picked up all over the country and all basically every newspaper, especially as newspapers have folded or reduced their food sections. I imagine AP is selling a lot more stories because of that. Do you see a big difference between the kinds of stories that are picked up in newspapers on the coasts versus the ones that, say, run in the South or run in the Midwest? Like, where are the interests, you know, besides the coast? Like, is everybody else focusing on food politics the way we are, or sustainability the way we do, or do you find that there is pretty much the same interest across the board?
You know, that is the information I would love to have. Technologically speaking, we haven't quite, we're not quite there yet, because the way the AP service works is we generate vast volumes of content across the board, you know, from politics coverage to local government to food and environment and so forth. And we send it out over what we call the wire and to our subscribers, our members, every day, all day. And our members and subscribers pick and choose what they wish to use. They don't report back to us in terms of what they use. And, you know, it's an a la carte situation in many ways, where they are presented with all of our stories and all of our content, and then they choose what makes sense for them to use for their readers. So I don't actually have a really good handle on what Des Moines is using versus, you know, Florida or whatever. But I can tell you that, in general, food editors at newspapers across the country, really, they want information, whether it's a news story or whether it's a recipe, they want information that busy families can use at the end of the day. So whether that's a story about pink slime that explains to a consumer, what do you need to know next time you go grocery shopping, and why is it important that you know this, or if it's a recipe that they can get on the table at the end of the workday, that seems to be the common thread, that local food editors want information, stories, recipes, news that their readers can use. And I think that's something a little bit different than what you find in elsewhere in the newspapers, where the goal is purely to inform in many cases. Mm-hmm. You know, we need to know what's going on in the Middle East, and we need to know what's going on overseas. But in the case of the food pages, a lot of it is news to use. And so they really want information that their readers can pick up and put into use in their lives.
I understand. So speaking to that, you recently, I saw a series of articles about your food stamp challenge, otherwise known as SNAP benefits. And in that particular challenge, you got two chefs, including Bill Telepan, who we know well and who's a chef here in New York, and a food editor and another chef to try to make ends meet on $68.27 per week for a family of four. So what made you choose to do that? And, you know, what did you think people would learn from seeing that?
Well, I mean, you know, we're very lucky in the sense that for most of us, for many of us, an exercise like this is a choice. Mm-hmm. That we can wonder, what is it like to live on $68 and so many cents a week in terms of food? That's a luxury, to be able to wonder that. It's a luxury to be able to say, well, let's find out. For far too many Americans, it's a reality, and there is no choice in it. It's no luxury, and it's extremely difficult. And one of the things we hear over and over again in the food world is that it is possible to eat very well without, you know, blowing the budget.
Yeah.
And oftentimes there is a knowledge gap in terms, because those of us, in kind of a sick irony, those of us who best know how to make a food dollar stretch are the people who least need to do it.
Yes.
You know, I mean, chefs are, you know, especially restaurant chefs, are pros at stretching a food dollar because it affects their bottom line.
Of course.
And so they know how to buy the proper cuts of meat that they can get at the best price and do the most with, you know, and so forth. And so they have that knowledge. The average family, whether they're on food stamps or not, doesn't have that knowledge. And so it's a real challenge to then say to these people, all right, well, you have less money than most. You need to stretch it more than most. And so I wanted to see, well, let's take that expertise. Let's talk to these folks who really you know, understand the idea of stretching a food dollar and see what they can do with you know, the average amount that a family of, I think it was a family of four, gets for a week in the United States on food stamps. And, you know, they did a great job. And again, they brought to the table an understanding of the economics of food shopping. And I think part of what, you know, we need if we, you know, in terms of helping folks on, who are trying to make do on food stamps, is to kind of share some of that knowledge. And so I was curious, well, what will these folks bring to the table? And, it was nothing, you know, it wasn't rocket science, but it was taking the time to really think consciously about the food choices they were making, what they were going to do with that food, and how were they going to maximize each item that they bought.
I actually thought that what they did was too complicated and expensive. And had I been given that challenge? Seriously, nobody did rice and beans. Nobody did a big soup with like a shank of beef, which creates, you know, an incredible amount of flavor, but, you know, relatively little expenditure. I mean, I was surprised. I thought the food was too fancy.
I think there were a few. I want to say one of them did. It's been a while since I looked at that story, but I want to say one of them did like a chicken soup. I think they did a roasted chicken, and then they turned some of the leftovers into soup. But you're right. You know, of course, they're also coming at it from a restaurant perspective. So while you have the benefit of their deeper understanding of food economics, you also have their tendency to go higher end than, and perhaps more labor intensive.
Yeah, Telepan went over budget $20.
Yeah, right. Yeah, which isn't an option for us. For most of us.
Exactly.
Yeah. And that was that again is the luxury of doing it theoretically.
Yeah.
And I'm forever thankful that I have that luxury. But for a lot of Americans, it's not. So it was really an interesting experience to see what they would come up with. And you're right. I mean, I think this is one of those equations that there's many ways to get at the answer. And, they chose probably more labor-intensive ways than the average American family can handle. And, I certainly don't have the sort of time to
They had people cooking basically almost every night. I think there was only one or two nights where you had something that you could eat twice. Jason, I want to say one more thing. We have to take a break in just a second, but I want to say one more thing about this. I mean, you touched on this a few minutes ago, but it seems to me that the main thing about making SNAP benefits work, or for anybody who wants to cook well and eat well at home, is a culinary education or culinary literacy, as my guest last week put it, which I thought was a really great way of putting it. And I wondered, you know, what do you think is the answer to creating that kind of education, or, you know, offering that kind of basic, essential knowledge about how to make rice and beans or a basic soup or something like that to families that don't have that expertise and may not even have that much access to cooking equipment?
Well, you know what's interesting is that you, in some ways, you answered your own question, because there was a time when everything you just described wasn't just common knowledge; it was basic knowledge to every American family. And we, in part, in the way that we've glorified food culture at this point, we've kind of separated ourselves from it in many ways, and we think of this culinary education or information as being, you know, professional chefs, that you have to go to culinary school, which is absolutely untrue. And it's more of a sense of getting back in the kitchen and cooking, because, you know, what you say is that they had people cooking every night. Well, yes, actually, people should be cooking every night. And it doesn't mean it's necessarily practical for everybody. And will everybody do it every night? Of course not, and they probably maybe even shouldn't. But once people get back in the kitchen and start cooking, those basic skills will be learned, will come back. I mean, obviously, there are many sources for that information these days, be it online or in books and so forth. But it's the act of cooking. You know, we need to go back to the act of cooking, and that's where that basic information comes from, so that you do know that if you buy a 4-pound whole chicken, it's a better value because you can make 2-3 meals out of it and, you know, two different things. And it's a better bargain than buying just the chicken breasts or you know, like that.
Right.
But you don't get that information by going out to dinner every night or getting takeout. You get that information by shopping and then coming home and cooking what you bought.
Right. Absolutely. Jason, stay on the line. We have to take a 30-second sponsor drop, and we'll be right back with Jason Hirsch from the AP.
Hearst Ranch grass-fed beef. Pasture raised on 150,000 acres in Central California. Hearst Ranch grass-fed beef, free-range, sustainably produced, humane. Hearst Ranch grass-fed beef, the authentic flavor of the American West.
We are back on Straight No Chaser on the Heritage Radio Network. My guest is Jason Hirsch, the food editor for the Associated Press. Jason, how did you like that commercial? That was the one and only Brian Kenny, the farm manager for Hearst Ranch. Wasn't that inspiring?
Indeed.
He's a great guy. He calls himself a spreadsheet cowboy, but he is so much more than that. He's just an amazing dude. Anyway, I wanted to walk into sort of the national aspect of food culture and talk a little bit about food politics, because, as you know, probably better than any of us, you know, there's this great groundswell of emotion and movement about changing our food systems. And I have to say that in general, I don't see a lot of food politics appearing in food sections, certainly not in my own, in the New York Times. If something really big happens, I guess they cover it. But I have to say that there has been a paucity of coverage of, say, the Farm Bill, subsidies, issues around, say, for instance, obesogens. I mean, that was something that came up in the news a couple weeks ago. I noticed an article, I think it was in The Atlantic, about, you know, the holy trinity of fat, sugar, and salt actually triggering a certain response in the brain that encourages you to eat more junk food. I don't see a lot of that stuff in food. I also don't see, I mean, aside from the pink slime story, I don't see a lot of interest in commercial food production per se. Do you think people are not interested in that, or are your advertisers not interested in having you cover that, or how do you think that plays out?
Well, I don't know about advertisers. They have nothing to do with what I decide to cover or not. Mm-hmm. But I will tell you, I actually have had the opposite response to what's been going on in media, and in particular food media. You know, I have been watching food media, or part of the food media, for many years now, and had you asked me 10 years ago, would, you know, stories about school lunches and pink slime and would Jamie Oliver have a show about reforming school lunch on ABC in prime time, I never would have believed you.
Yeah.
You know, would the vegan and eco-sensitive diet, for lack of a better term, be nearly as, I'm not going to call them mainstream, but boy, they're a lot closer to the mainstream than they were 10, 15 years ago.
Absolutely.
I have been shocked at the response and heartened by the response of the American consumer in terms of a desire to know more about food. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, look at the success of some of the movies that have come out, from Super Size Me to Food, Inc., and sure, so forth. I have been really, really shocked by the level and extent of interest and knowledge that people want and have of food culture, food politics. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if you just look at the New York Times food section, which I will neither praise nor beat up, but, you know, that is one small slice of food media at the moment. When you get online and you realize that there are thousands and thousands of blogs following and chronicling every little step of the Farm Bill, for example, and the school lunch reform effort and so forth. And some of those blogs were instrumental in, for example, exposing pink slime and turning it into, what it became. I'm amazed, fascinated, and so impressed that people are so interested in food today that it has become an online entity unto itself. I mean, you know, people talk about mommy blogs, people talk about food blogs, and it becomes such a component of our awareness of what we're putting in our bodies. You know, look at it this way. 15 years ago, if you had said that Walmart was going to start selling organic,
yeah, really,
and not just a little, you know, they went whole hog into organic.
Or even the pink slime story Burger King and McDonald's dropped pink slime. That was national news,
exactly.
And that was on the heels of consumer outrage.
Exactly, and companies are responding to consumer demand to know more about what's in their food. Mm-hmm. Are we still a processed food society? Yes, absolutely. Is that a good thing? You know, I'll leave that to others to debate. But people are demanding to know more about their food, what they're putting in their bodies, and what they choose to do with that information is a separate matter. But they are demanding to know more about food and how it affects the rest of their lives. And I think that's fantastic. I mean, I think more information is always better.
You know what? I'm just thinking about that and thinking that, you know, a lot of that information is in the blogosphere, as you say, and that therefore would be dependent on owning a computer and having computer skills sufficient to allow you to track those. So, you know what I think about this right now is like, is there going to be a sort of division in the country where there's half of the country or the same people who have the luxury of not using food stamps, who are able to control what they put in their bodies, versus the people who don't get that information and who continue to support, unwittingly, but still support, sort of the big processed food manufacturers. I feel there's a real danger in that split in the food system here. What about you?
I think, across the board in not just our country, but in many developed countries, there is definitely an information and perhaps you can even say internet divide, mm-hmm. culturally speaking. You know, people who have access to the information, people who have access to the internet, and oftentimes those go hand in hand. And, you know, that is a bigger problem than just the food world. Does it also affect the food world? Absolutely. You know, and that's what we're talking about, which is the idea that the people who most need those food economy skills generally least have the least of them.
Yes.
And that's something that, you know, that a lot of people are trying to remedy, not just in the food world, but they're trying to remedy it across the board in this kind of information divide and get the information to the people who need it. And, you know, so I don't know that that's necessarily a food solution. I think there are plenty of people who are trying to do something about that. I mean, you see this effort led by Michelle Obama to get chefs into their local schools to teach children about food and what it means to grow food and produce it and get it into your body and what healthy eating means. I mean, I think that's a great example where, you know, if we put chefs in the school, you know, you've now bridged that information divide. And I think that's just one of many examples of what's going on.
Well, I think chefs in the school is great. I think chefs in the school is great, but I think that a lack of like basic hands-on instruction in the form of a home ec class or something like that is what's really needed here. I mean, you know, they've been having kids have been seeing chefs in their schools. I mean, my daughter went through public elementary school education here in New York, and she saw some great chefs come in and prepare a salad for them. And it was like, yeah, big deal. You know, I mean, and they had a garden there and the whole bit. And my kid is lucky she grew up with a good cook. But, you know, most of the kids in her class, you know, they kept on eating their Doritos. So what about something
kids that, you know, it's absolutely true. You know, there's still plenty of room for progress. I think, this is, one step of many that need to be taken. And, I think the idea is to kind of plant those seeds that hopefully children will grow up and have a respect for food. It's not going to change overnight. We didn't become dependent on processed food and kind of lose touch with cooking skills overnight. It's not going to be remedied overnight.
Yeah, I don't know. I kind of feel that we did almost. I feel like the post-war generation, you know, like in the 50s when women started, you know, were leaving were the home more and more for the workplace, and then TV dinners came into play, and it was like, I remember saying to my parents, like, oh my God, can't we please have TV dinner for dinner? My mom was an amazing cook. You know, I was begging for that processed food. I thought it was really cool that it came in a tray with little slots, blah, blah, blah.
Oh, sure.
You know, so I think it was really, I mean, granted it was, like 50 years ago, because of course I'm 56, but, you know, it was 20, I think it was really about 15 or 20 years of, you know, of commercial food production being pushed at you as a convenience as more and more women entered the workplace. And that was when cooking just went right out the window. And, you know,
absolutely. But, you know, I think it took several decades before we truly, you know, before processed food, you know, became
the norm as opposed to the exception.
Exactly. And now, I mean, you look at families today, and they are cooking so much more today than they were 10, 15 years ago.
That is for sure.
They know so much more about food than they did 10, 15, 20 years ago. I mean, it's definitely where I feel like, you know, we've kind of dipped, and now we're coming back up. Mm-hmm. And again, the first part of the equation is wanting to know.
Yeah.
And all of the evidence I see, even if people are still reaching for their, you know, their Doritos or their fast food or whatever, the first step is people wanting to know. And all signs I see point in the direction that people want to know more about their food. What they do with that information is a completely separate issue. I think the first point is to see that they want the information and that it's being given to them. And like I say, more than ever before, there are more sources to get that information, and so that people can be informed about food. And I mean everything from understanding the Farm Bill and to school lunch reform to knowing how to cook and roast chicken.
Yeah.
And, you know, that is basic and, you know, and as important as understanding how Farm Bill policy affects, you know, your school lunch and what you can buy at your grocery store and organic, you know, certification standards and so forth. I mean, it's just as important. And people, again, if you look, you know, I get the stats from Yahoo on search engine, on food stats. And one of the things that they say every week is people want to know about how to cook chicken, how to roast a chicken, how to do chicken breasts. People want to know.
Yeah.
And again, I think that's kind of that first step. And I think it's fantastic. People seem to want to know much more than they did, you know, 10, 15, 20 years ago.
Well, we have to wrap it up now, Jason, but I can say, I think without hesitation and with no, shall we say, false praise here, that you've probably had a lot to do with that revolution in terms of people seeking that information. I mean, you've been the food editor at AP for quite a while now. So, you know, you certainly are in the forefront of deciding what people read and getting the information to them. So I was going to ask you about Lunchbox Blues, but I don't have time. But I will encourage people to go to your website, which is www.lunchboxblues.com, which is a very funny and entertaining blog about what you feed your son. I really got a kick out of it.
Someday he thinks it's entertaining too.
Yeah, well, I loved the idea of the, what was it, peanut butter and pretzel sandwich. Good
that
for him.
Idea.
Yeah, rock on, Parker. Anyway, thank you so much for doing this with me, Jason. I really enjoyed it. I hope you'll come back another time. I thought this was a really fun
Absolutely.
Discussion. And I can imagine having
Absolutely.
Many more of the same. Okay, great. Thanks a lot. And thanks to my sponsor, Hearst Ranch, for joining me today on Straight No Chaser. And we'll see you next week, folks. Thanks a lot for tuning in. All the best.
Listeners, we want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway, and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Awali, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.